Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And folks, we've already, I think we covered it to ad nauseum, going through the from the Tory acts, preparing for the Revolutionary War and getting organized. And then actually, the one thing I really didn't cover, and I don't know if we need to, but we've got Paul with us, and I can ask him because I haven't actually talked about this. So welcome back, Paul.
Good morning. I mean, hi, GR.
So that's okay. So here's the question. I covered the Tory acts, and I kind of mentioned that, you know, this was the establishment of the shadow government. In other words, we were currently and proudly members of Britain, and as a matter of fact, they were esteemed and loyal, the most loyal and noble members of Britain, as they sent out the, you know, the, Articles of Association.
Okay.
Right? That I just had to remember the name, so bear with me. So we sent that, and they kind of established the fact that these men were, you know, doing everything they could to preserve their rights as Englishmen. And it was only getting worse with the British Crown, Parliament, and so forth. And they were just literally turning their backs on America. And so when they were done, and I didn't cover this, so here's the question. Should we try to research and provide the details on the deportation of the Tories?
You know, I have always had questions about that. In fact, I've personally had a challenge justifying it. I think we probably ought to, because if I've had a challenge with it, there are people who would have this question. Okay, I really do think we ought to cover.
Yeah, and so I guess the best way to kind of gloss over it, because, you know, it takes a while to do the due diligence on the deportation, mm-hmm. and how that was done, because I think it was left to the states at the time.
Okay.
And it was definitely, because there's nothing in Continental Congress, or at least in these amendments and so forth, that I'm aware of that talks about the Tories and the removal of the British loyalists. But we do know that that occurred prior to the Constitution.
Right.
I believe it also occurred during the point in time that the Treaty of Versailles, or the Treaty of Paris, was occurring.
Okay.
And so one of the things that instantly dragged from the Treaty of Paris into further discussions with Britain was the fact that Britain wanted compensation for the loss of property.
Hmm.
Because even though we mentioned it in the I talked about this with McKibbins, because he talked about the fact that we gave them their property in the treaty. Well, we never did give them the property, which is one of the reasons why Britain started impressing our soldiers, or actually our ships and sailors, and so forth. So here's one thing that I think is important to keep in mind, that when you look at progressive reporting, right, when you look at what hits CNN and MSNBC and those who are trying to present a very specific narrative, then, you know, and you go read what is stated on Wikipedia, because Wikipedia isn't necessary. I mean, it's really an open source. Everybody can grind their own agenda. But right. if you read Wikipedia on the expulsion of the Tories and the British loyalists, you'll find that, you know, shoot, that was well over 100. I believe it was over 100,000. I don't know if they report that those numbers may, you know, because they're subject to change because it's always to and fro, right? You know, somebody wants to make it look like, you know, really bad thing or really good thing for their political agenda. But my point is that if at least Wikipedia acknowledges the fact that we kicked out people who were, you know, had equal rights to property and everything else here in America because they were loyalist to Britain, we considered that unexcusable and, you know, unforgivable, and we basically expelled them. Now, the Belvoirs, I do know when, if you read, and I think, I'm trying to remember who wrote the biography. I think it was Ron Chernow on George Washington. I know he did Alexander Hamilton, and I think it was Ron Chernow, and I believe it was in that biography that he talks about George Washington and his infatuation for Mrs. Belvoir. And
yes, I heard about that.
Okay, so he had this, it wasn't a physical affair, but he had a romantic feelings for Mrs. Belvoir.
And they wrote to each other.
What's that?
They wrote to each other.
Oh, yes, constantly. And it was maybe just playful. Maybe it's something she just kind of enjoyed, you know, playing with this, you know, young man of prominence. Her husband was a man of prominence as well. I mean, the Belvoir property ended up becoming Fort Belvoir.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, Fort Belvoir is a pretty big fort, folks. It's just outside of D.C. And my point is this, is that when we look at, you know, the Belvoirs themselves, Ron Chernow basically stated that George Washington walked down, or he was at the pier side to say goodbye to the Belvoirs when they actually took a ship back to Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know how many people went back to Britain, but I know Wikipedia reports almost 100,000 people were basically pushed into Canada.
Okay.
And I guess there was enough people pushed into Canada, which created a division in Canada regarding the French, you know, control over Canada and the British control over Canada. And it kind of suited Britain because the Canadian, or I should say the French, kind of, you know, were compressed into a small area. What is it, Montreal? Right. Or is Quebec. It Quebec? Quebec. There, Quebec. Yeah, that's right. And so anyway, so my point is that, you know, Britain could thank America for expelling their loyalists into Canada so that they now have Canada as a part of their Commonwealth.
Hmm. Okay.
Right? I mean, had we, you know, not let them go to the north and said, you know what, we're pushing them all back to Britain. We could put them all on slow ships and they're all going back to Britain. They want to come back this way, then they'll have to, you know, get on another ship and pay their passage or what have you. But instead, we just kind of push them out. Anyway, so if Wikipedia reports this, then as far as I'm concerned, the narrative has to really come down to this. And this is why I believe when we look at the obligation of a citizen, and one of the things that they learned from the lack of support for the revolution and this movement of liberty, they basically, I'll just say, bolstered up the oath of a citizen to basically let them, you know, legally affirm and state the oath that they would take up arms to support and defend the Constitution.
Right.
Not the government. They didn't want, because they understood governments could become corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't want, you know, this blind faith and loyalty towards an office, a government, you know, a body of people they wanted to make sure that the loyalty was to the Constitution. And I guess it, because if you really look at the our forefathers' plight going into the Revolution, they were willing to fight and die for their rights under the Bill of Rights as sure. Englishmen. And so they, in a way, they took that Englishman oath, or that, I'll just say, the birthright of being an Englishman, those rights underneath the Bill of Rights or the Glorious Bill of Rights, they just considered that sacred.
Right.
And so that creates the context to, you know, why they framed the oath the way they did.
Sure.
And so if we look today, I mean, it's one thing for somebody to just say something disparagingly, you know, to be the clown or the, you know, the peanut gallery and saying, you know what, the U.S. government sucks or what have you. That's hyperbole, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's another thing when you actually take action against the Constitution. So here's mm-hmm. the question. If we had the same paradigm as the framers, would we take lightly people attacking the Constitution?
No, we wouldn't. If we had the same paradigm as the framers, we'd probably put them on a slow boat to the communist country of their choice.
Okay, so correct. I agree. And we're going to get into this, but let's just take a little, you know, let's say we're looking into the future from this constitutional point, because what we're going to cover today, folks, and probably for the next week or so, we're going to go through the Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, because there's some really important parts that we've talked about or that we've kind of covered, and we want to hear how Madison kind of captured this. And so looking at, you know, this new government that they formed and created from this Constitution, what did they do when the first rebellion against the federal actions, which was the whiskey tax, or what they called the, you know, the distilled liquor tax or what have you, they just ended up calling it the whiskey tax, but what happened?
Well, they called for the militia.
Yeah, they called for it. So they followed the Constitution. And we're going to go through this again mm-hmm. because I want to go through all of this. And what we're really trying to do is we're trying to start from the Revolution to go as far as we can go through American history in this year. You know, spending a lot of time on the Constitution and constitutional things, like the next thing we're going to cover is the ratification debates after this. So, because that's the logical sequence. And then after that, we'll cover, you know, the cod fishery bounties, or actually we'll cover the Assumption Act and cod fishery bounties. Then we'll go into the bank, you know, the formation of the National Bank and some of those things that actually occurred. And the Whiskey Rebellion follows that, because the Whiskey Rebellion, I think it was 1794. So we'll push that to be after. But here's my point. When they captured 24 men, this was the men who signed and understood the Constitution, right?
Right.
What did they charge these men with for uprising against this federal tax?
They charged them with treason.
They charged them with treason. So when we see people supporting this invasion, when we see people, I mean, based on, you know, the precedents that the framers gave us, how is any of this crap going on? Not treasonous.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just posing it out there because you can't convince me otherwise that these people were only revolting against attacks and they were willing to do some property damage, but we're not talking about an insurrection in the same likeness as what happened under Trump during, you know, the pandemic.
They don't know what an insurrection is. I've told my audiences, there was an insurrection on January 6th, but it did not come from outside the Capitol building.
Sure, right. Right. It came from inside. And so my point is and I'm trying to drive this, that when we really look at how sacred they considered liberty and in establishing a land of liberty, and that the supreme law secured those things, mm-hmm. individual liberty and individual sovereignty, when you attack the Constitution, then, you know, God help you, because you should be charged with treason, and you should either be, you know, dangling from the end of a rope or being deported. And I'm more of the opinion that we should start just deport people, because dangling from the end of the rope, that's, I mean, it's just like how we kind of turn a society, Vietnam just comes to mind. When we started seeing the death in American living room that was happening in Vietnam, regardless mm-hmm. of the context, right? I mean, when I forget who that man was that was shot in the head, but I do remember seeing that, and, you know, seeing that historically several times in my life, because it was always being brought forward as something in context to the evils of war and how America mm-hmm. had gone too far. And I'm going, you know, I'm not sure about the context behind what was happening, but I do know this, that though that type of imagery and that type of action, a reaction, causes a society to, you know, to, I'll just say, shift their paradigm. It causes yeah. them to move or change their sentiments. That's a better word. Change sure. their sentiments for what they're fighting for, what they're trying to do.
Sure.
And so that's why I think that if we really look at deporting and we try to take that type of approach. So anyway, I digress. One thing I didn't get a chance to cover, and I'm not sure if you knew this or anybody else had heard this, but apparently last October there was a huge breach in access to people's accounts that were created with 23andMe. Now, so 23andMe was that, you know, really popular website that you could send your DNA, your saliva, what have you, mm-hmm. into them, and they would actually do this, you know, DNA test. And the more people that started doing it, they started, you know, creating this huge database. And so the stuff that was actually compromise was the names, the birth years, the relationship info, and other data such as genetic ancestry results and so forth. So, I mean, this was a huge breach. Huge breach. So this goes down the path of the Fourth Amendment.
Right.
And I'm absolutely, positively odd, you know, at odds, I should say. I guess that's the better way. But I'm absolutely, you know, trying to shake my head, go, how did we get here? In other mm-hmm. words, you know, when we read the Fourth Amendment, and the Fourth Amendment basically states, let me pull it up here. Okay, so the Fourth Amendment states this, that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause. And so when we look at a tech company that, you know, you happen to give information to, is it legitimate in the United States for them to be able to sell that information? Is it legitimate in the United States based on the Fourth Amendment? Because every company that operates in the United States has to abide by the law. Mm-hmm. In other words, you have to provide security measures and you have to maintain this. But see, that's not what big tech has been doing. Big tech mm-hmm. has been violating our Fourth Amendment rights left and right.
So here's a question.
Yeah.
And by the way, I've been in technology for a while, so I actually read user agreements. Most people don't. They just click the button, and they keep right on going. But they click the button that says, you know, privacy statement. We can give your information to the government, you know, with a warrant. You know, so are you saying that we can't even agree to give up our rights?
I am telling you that there is no way a company or even a local government or a state government or the federal government can acknowledge and actually enforce an agreement that violates your rights. In other words, the 14th Amendment, no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. So, okay, answer me this. How is it that a corporation in the good state of California can create a law such as a contract agreement that says they can do whatever they want to with your data when you have these inalienable rights that cannot be denied? And now this company basically said, I've got you to sign this, whether you read it or not. That contract isn't even worth the paper it's printed on. Because it's in the United States, and it happens to be something that if you want to go actually and say you had no right to take this information, well, you signed this away. You cannot take away my rights by a contract.
So let's make sure I understand this. So let's push this up the chain for a minute. Uh-huh. They can't do that for one. California, as a state, party of the Constitution, must abide by the Constitution.
Uh-huh.
Anything chartered under its jurisdiction must also abide by the Constitution.
That's correct.
So, that's correct. Means, so,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, no. So what I was going to say real quick is, let's just say, there's a card game going, and, let's say, there's a real evil person at the table, and they basically, play and they bet, each other's wives, or they bet, a child, one of their children. Can that person actually enforce, based on that bet, based on the agreement, even if it was a written down agreement that you have to surrender that child, can the state actually enforce that? Now, I'm not sure if you're there, if you're on mute.
I'm here.
Yeah.
I haven't said anything.
Sure haven't. So, the beautiful thing about radio is it doesn't allow for long pauses.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Well, so what happened is, historically, people have tried to enforce things like that, even as stupid as they are.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And the problem with me, the problem is that it's inconceivable to me that someone would even make an agreement like that. Do you understand?
Right, I mean? Yeah.
It's just inconceivable that someone is just, that's why I paused. It's just outside of my mindset that someone would even consider making an agreement like that.
Right. And so I'm not sure if it's ever happened, but I would think that it's well within the realm of reason that HOAs, have formed where they basically in their HOA agreement basically get everybody to sign that you won't keep any guns in your home.
Mm.
I mean, we're at that point societal. And there may be everybody that lives in that and have been abiding by that, not having any guns in Beverly Hills or what have you, right?
Right.
That they're not storing any guns in their homes. And, all of a sudden you move in there and you see this HOA agreement to say, hey, you can't have any guns in your home. You can't store any. So here's the question. Can the HOA enforce that? And so we're going into break, so now you can have a real long pause and think about that question. Can an HOA deny you your inalienable rights? Can a city go, can a city basically say, we are gunless, you can't have guns in our city? Can they actually do that? We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so, you know, actually, let's make a contrast, and I'm not sure if you thought about this, but let's make a contrast, because when we look at what the supreme law of the land is, mm-hmm. what is it?
That's the Constitution.
It is the Constitution. Now, let me ask you this. If we called the supreme law of the land the Bible, mm-hmm. could one actually find themselves more in jeopardy of, you know, losing a child or suffering, you know, an unjust death because of some, you know, contract or agreement?
Well, when you say unjust, according to the Bible, it may not be. But yes, you probably could. Especially in the Old Testament.
Okay, so, but you see my point, because of maybe ambiguity, interpretation, and actually the interpretations of the different versions and so forth. I mean, it's been completely perverted in so many different ways. And so, you know, maybe the divine hand of providence knew all of this. Mm-hmm. Maybe he understood that the only way he could secure liberty for all is to create a supreme law that secures liberty for all.
Okay.
So how is it in America we see corporations take our data, our information, you know, whether it be your DNA or anything like that, and keep it in a database where it can be accessed and it can be hacked, or taking it and actually making money off of selling your information? I mean, a friend of mine was just hacked last week. They were just hacked. And so when all of a sudden, you know, all of this person's friends started contacting them going, hey, I just got an email from you, and I don't think this is you. Yeah, I got hacked. I'm sorry. You know, and it took her a whole day just getting people through the phones because she couldn't email anybody. So right. She was looking for some help and so forth. I'm telling you, if you've ever had somebody come into your home and rob you, if you've ever had somebody steal your car or steal your data, folks, this is an essence of an ultimate violation.
We've had both. I've had it happen.
Yeah.
And I was walking out my door to a job interview, and I said, Susan, where's the car? Well, the car had been stolen. Okay. That's it.
So I had my car stolen, and I walked out to, you know, okay, so where's my car? So I walked back in thinking, because, you know, my wife and I, we would prank each other all the time, and I just started laughing. I go, okay, where'd you put it? And she kind of looked at me, and she goes, what do you mean? And I go, where'd you put my car? And she goes, I don't know what you're talking about. And I go, well, the car's not there. And she goes, well, and she ran out with me, and she goes, it must have been stolen, because I didn't do that.
Right.
And all of a sudden, at that point, I realized how violated I was.
Yeah, it's an awful feeling, GR. And you know, the other thing I think we ought to point out is that these corporations are fictitious entities. Okay, they're not. They have, and we've set them up in such a way that they have unlimited financial resources.
Yeah, but what do they operate? So let me ask you, what is the fundamental purpose of a corporation in operation?
To profit.
Yes, you to know, take.
That, I mean,
to take and make.
Sure. I mean, the lifeblood of a corporation is money.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we have to have constraints, and believe it or not, the Constitution constrains them. They can't, if they take your data, then they can't share that with anybody. And as a matter of fact, I can't believe that there's not one state in the union that has not locked down corporations in being able to sell off their citizens' data. Why? And so this all came from where? Where did all this evil come from? The federal government. The federal government started allowing, see, can one state operate the way it – so if I created a corporation in one state and then I started going into all of these other states and I wanted to operate, you know, a very particular way, but some states would say, hey, you know, you can't do that. We'd go, hold on. Yes, I can. You know, no, you can't. Every state has the responsibility of regulating based on the law. And if one state allows a corporation to, you know, be pernicious or nefarious or what have you, then that doesn't mean that every state has to allow that to happen. But what ended up happening was the federal government came along because corporations dragged them in. And I believe that in some ways this was all a big setup with Standard and the Trustbusters and all of that. They created the state so that the federal government could regulate corporations, unconstitutionally, by the way, but that's how all of a sudden corporations had this immunity from state governments, and they don't.
Correct.
Go ahead.
So in an ideal situation, corporations would have to deal with each state on its own terms.
Absolutely. And
in a constitutional situation.
Absolutely. They would have to ensure that the corporation is operating within the confines of the Constitution, both the U.S. as well as the state. Now, see, the state can actually create tighter regulations. Does that make sense?
Yes. Right.
So when we start looking at, are we in a race to seek the lowest ground man can obtain? Are we in a race to obtain the highest ground that mankind could obtain? See, our Constitution, this government, was based on principles of enlightenment and seeking higher ground and higher ground and higher ground. Then all of a sudden, it became a gold rush to the bottom. And I literally mean that, a gold rush to the bottom.
Right.
So, sorry for this long discourse of, you know, what happened with 23andMe. But, folks, I mean, if you want to feel like you've been violated, and that's, you know, if you're a part of that 7 million people that had contributed your DNA, you know, you have been violated. And as a matter of fact, you need to be contacting your state legislators instead of contacting, you know, Norton or, you know, Title Lock. You know, you lose your title. I just can't believe the corporations are getting away with allowing you to be stripped of all of your rights.
So let's go back to this for just a little bit.
Okay.
You know, I have been pursuing my family history since as long as I can remember. So then comes companies like Ancestry.com and 23andMe, and you agree with them to do a service for you so you can determine, you know, where your ancestry came from, okay, what your roots are. So is, you know, should they... I'm trying to figure out, because people are, I know people are really happy with the service, you know, some of my family members. So I'm trying to figure out, if there's even a right way to do this, you know, maybe they use it to determine something, and then they either lock it down or leave it in control of the owner and don't have any access to it. You see what I'm saying?
So let's just look at that scenario. Let's say, you know, you get into a genealogical website like Ancestry.com, mm-hmm. and you join up, and they basically say, okay, we have to operate by respecting your privacy, and we're presuming that you're coming in here to, you know, basically build your own family tree. However, you know, amongst our users, we want to make sure that people, you know, can share their access, because that's the whole point of all of this is sharing right. access to your personal information to find out mm-hmm. if you're related or not.
Right.
And so, okay, you can give, you know, complete open access, and that's something you're willing to allow, but mm-hmm. to actually have that company take that data and give it to government, or take mm-hmm. that data and give it to another company, then okay. they have to get your approval. Now, you can also operate in a bubble to where you operate and they say, okay, you know, we have links to other people and their records, but mm-hmm. you have to request whether that person will share their records with you or not.
Okay.
And in other words, you could create, you know, a law that requires that type of approval, right?
So, yeah, sure.
To where nobody gets just direct access. They have to request. Or you could create many different degrees of, you know, if it's somebody, you know, within the United States, or if it's somebody, mm-hmm. you know, within the same state or what have you, or whatever. I mean, I guess you could get into an infinite way of creating scenarios, but bottom line, the rights of the people have to be observed.
So here's then the other scenario is this. There really can't be a circumstance in which your private information is given to the government. Or can there?
No, you're right. There can't be any way without your approval or without a warrant.
Right.
And as far as I'm concerned, every state in the union needs to actually provide the individual a copy of the warrant that they received in, you know, searching for your information.
Right. Probably before. Okay. Right.
And so
because people's information is given away without their knowledge. And if it's without their knowledge, it's obviously without their consent, even though they've signed an agreement. And I've read these agreements.
Right.
Because they say, by the way, we may share this with law enforcement. We may share this with our partners for these reasons, et cetera. Okay. And maybe we should do that differently.
Yeah, absolutely. So as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, if they bust down your door because you're not home, mm-hmm. that's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a matter of fact, there has to be some respect for the property owner.
I think if they bust down your door, if you are home, it's not acceptable.
Oh, absolutely. No. I'm just saying, okay, so in the pursuit of trying to exercise this search warrant.
Yes, right.
You know, and unless, you know, there is an absolute evidence that there's a life in the balance, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, life has got to be because it's a priority for government to protect life and property. They can't throw your property rights away when they're just trying to find out whether you might have committed, you know, embezzled money or something like that. I mean,
sure.
It's not like there's a life in the balance. Somebody's, you know, going to be dead if they don't, you know, get this data within a certain amount of time. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense. But I'll tell you what's worse. And we should highlight this. Sometimes there's a life in the balance when the government knocks down your door. You ever heard of a no-knock warrant? We've had people get killed by government because these folks thought they were defending their homes from intruders.
Sure.
That there is, I can't imagine anything more blatant than the idea that government can knock down your door and then has the right to shoot you with impunity,
right?
with no warning, no rights accepted, protected. It's beyond pale. Okay, and certainly I want to make kind of another comment, if you don't mind. And that is, I think it's time that we stop looking for heroes in government, okay? Looking for saviors, looking for, hey, Ron Paul will save us, or Ross Perot will save us, or even Donald Trump will save us. I think the people need to look in the mirror and say, we need to work together and save ourselves. You know, the Constitution is the hero here, but we need to defend it. So I'm sorry, I've kind of gone off on a...
No. This all kind of boils down to how important it is that your state actually takes, I don't want to say protective. They take the Constitution as verbatim as the supreme law of the land, you know, because they've created so many different appendages and so forth that we're seeing so many things happening that are just absolutely violations of our rights. Mm-hmm. We have, when you really look at it, 500 years ago, where did all of the wealth reside?
500 years ago,
when you looked at the your local wealth, you looked at, you know, wealth in a picture and so forth. Where did the wealth, 500, you know, so
it,
let
it
me
resided
see.
Resided with the monarchs.
So, right? Okay. It resided either with the government or?
Or the kings or queens.
Or?
Well, they are the government.
Or?
Or who?
So,
church?
Actually, yeah, the church. So let's just go 1,000 years back, because 1,000 years ago, they didn't really have a bank. But I would say 500 years ago, that would be, 1600, right? So that year of 1600, I believe that's when banks started getting established. And so banks became a central repository, even though that wasn't their wealth. That started becoming a central repository where they possess the wealth. But let's go back 1,000 years. And when you really look at who possessed, you know, and amassed the world's value, it was either government or a church.
Right.
It's like the Catholic Church, or possibly when you look at the contrast in England, or you look at the contrast, you know, throughout these states that created state-sponsored churches, you can say, well, the church either amassed all of the money or and shared the other half, or there was this co-sharing of money, power, and control. So, in other words, the control over we the people, you know, 1,000 years ago was, you know, in the hands of very, you know, very elite bodies, government and so forth. How has that changed today? Now we see where, you know, so when we look at the masses, we look at corporations as the vestibules of wealth, right? But then we actually look beyond that, and we actually see that there are people that own those corporations, and we see people that own multiple corporations. I mean, Warren Buffett, what company does he own?
Well, his company is Berkshire Hathaway.
There you go.
That company owns lots of companies. That's his business.
Okay. You see, but that's my point. He didn't start. So when we look at, you know, Ford, we look at some of these corporations that started from ground zero, and mm-hmm. they actually amassed this wealth because of their successes, you know, mm-hmm. in selling, producing and selling products, what have you, like Starbucks. Starbucks really didn't produce anything other than a service in making coffee for people, right? So it's
right.
Not that they, you know, they do make a product, but they don't actually grow those beans. They right. Basically assemble an end product that's more of a service for people. So it's more of a service industry, right? But, I mean, so Starbucks is this, you know, large corporation. Elon Musk owns multiple corporations now, right?
Right.
Starlink.
Sure.
And, you know, and
SpaceX.
Right. So, well, SpaceX.
And Tesla.
Well, there's X, right? Twitter, former Twitter.
Right. There's X, SpaceX, Tesla. Yep.
And
Starlink.
Tesla and so forth. Right. So when we start looking at, you know, where the wealth is really amassed today, does the wealth, as a matter of fact, I just saw this in the news that a gentleman is basically entertaining Saudi Arabia and the Arab nations for $7 trillion to start manufacturing AI chips. In other words, chips
really?
To basically create a dominance of artificial intelligence.
$7 trillion?
$7 trillion is what he's trying to... That's... You know, that's a fraction of the GDP, of the United States GDP. And I believe this is an American citizen. But this guy is really trying to create a deal to start manufacturing chips in, you know, Saudi Arabia for Islam. You know, well, it'll be under in that government. And you can't tell me that things that happen in Saudi Arabia is for the people or, you know, anything like that, right?
Right.
Okay, so... Because we actually see Saudi Arabia and some Arab nations buying up corporations. They've bought up the PGA. This is all unconstitutional, friends. There is no way a foreign entity could own anything in the United States unless the federal government is actually violating the Constitution and allowing it to happen. They don't have the authority to allow this to happen.
You know what, GR? I think this is one of those things. You know, in last week we talked about briefly, I think this is one of those things that has slipped in under the radar, because I did a little research and it appears that even though you and I think the Constitution is pretty clear about this, it appears that early on we let the camel's nose get under the tent, you know, no pun intended, and then it's now in the tent because it's not something that we were enforcing. Okay, so I try to determine from some research, when did we start allowing foreign companies or
right.
foreign entities or foreigners to own land in the United States?
Right.
And I think we've been doing it since the beginning. But when you and I read the Constitution, it doesn't seem to be there.
Right. So one of the things that happened was, you know, when you came here, they had a standardization of naturalization. In other
sure.
words, when you came here, you had to be registered as an immigrant. You mm-hmm. just couldn't just come here and, you know, and start buying things up. As a matter of fact, there's no way they would have allowed, a Saudi prince or even the king of Britain to come and start buying things up because he had deep pockets. There's just no mm-hmm. way.
Right.
There's no way they would just allow that to happen. Because the federal government's responsibility is to protect state sovereignty, not to mm-hmm. sell us outright and to sell us to the highest bidder.
Correct.
That is repugnant to the principles of state sovereignty and sovereignty of we the people.
It would undo the union.
Absolutely. And so they don't have the authority to do that. Nor did they. So one of the things that was occurring was people would come here as immigrants. They would register. Now, you got to remember that the first 20 years, who controlled immigration?
The states did.
The states did. That's right. Most people don't understand that. So some of the new states that came into the union, such as New Hampshire, Tennessee, Kentucky, and I'm trying to think of until 1808, Louisiana was another one. So the importation of persons was controlled by the state. Then in 1808, the federal government assumed full control. And the only right. reason the states were allowed that 20-year, you know, I'll just say suspension of federal enforcement was because of the slave trade. Mm-hmm. The state said we need to do this because we've lost way too many. In other words, there were a large number of black freemen in America.
Right.
And so they said that we need to replace, you know, those slaves that we've lost via the war and the emancipation because of the war. And so, right. So, okay. They made this huge, and we're going to cover this, by the way, folks. We're going to make this, you know, so that you understand how and what was said, because that's why we're going to go through Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And this way we'll uncover. So you're going to hear what they said. You hear all sorts of people speculate and editorialize our history. But that's the furthest thing from the truth. And we're going to actually hear from, you know, the mouths of our framers what they really did say and what was behind all of that. So in 1808, when the federal government took over, they already started creating the uniform rule of naturalization prior to the 1808 clause. And they basically started stating that, you know, once you have to basically obtain approval to be here, and then, you know, when you've migrated, you're considered a migrant becoming a U.S. citizen, and you need to naturalize. You can't naturalize. I think you had to be you had to live here for a year. And this is how they played it all out. They came up with these standards. You had to be here for a year. You had to own some property. So in other words, you had to kind of put some skin in the game. I don't even think you had to own property, but I think if you own property, it was one of those accelerants that gave you access to citizenship. But you right. had to be in immigration status. Just imagine the, you know, some person getting off the ship, coming in and, you know, throwing down some gold and saying, I'm buying up this town. And then they get back on the ship and go back to the motherland. Mm-hmm. And they leave agents there to actually enforce what they want to do in that town. Just imagine right. if that ever tried to happen.
Actually, I think it is happening, but it's under our noses.
But it is happening today, but there's no way that could have happened under our Constitution with mm-hmm. the framers' paradigm.
Right.
We've only started accepting, and this is kind of like what they have done to the Constitution is very similar to what they've done with the Bible.
Okay.
Because they've tried to reinterpret and they've tried to basically stretch it and they've tried to find ways to aggrandize their power through precedence, case law, interpretation, all of these same things. And, you know, when we really look at the Bible is supposedly the Word of God. And so we're in the same boat and we actually have the actual words. We don't have to have interpretations. We actually have the men that explained exactly what this Constitution meant. And that's why it is so important. I can't say this any better, and I only got 13 seconds, so I can't believe the whole show slipped by. I cannot fathom how we're not reading the ratification to understand this Constitution so that we can actually stop all of these perversions to our Constitution. It is that critical, folks, which is why... The whole heart of this show, really, the heart of this show every year is going through the ratification debates and these fundamental documents. This is why, you know, I'm not here to entertain you. I'm here to empower you. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org
and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.